Time to take a look at your pet's health as we talk with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. If you have a question for Sandy, I hope you'll join us. You can reach us by phone at 1-800-642-1234 or via email, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Hey, it's nice to be back, Larry.
You came today filled with great information about a whole bunch of topics, and one of them had to do with the most expensive breeds in terms of health for dogs.
Well, you know, people always are surprised to hear that a veterinarian carries pet insurance on her dogs. Okay,
And you do.
And I do. And the reason is that I work at the Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital, and I don't do surgery. And so, you know, and being a state employee, you know, we pay the same as everybody else does
for
veterinary care. There's no breaks for us. So if all I need is one major surgery, and, you know, it's going to wipe out a little bit of my retirement account. So it wasn't surprising to see that the top breed for expense was
your dog,
the English Bulldog. Yes. You know, and they are in the top 10 breeds right now. And people, when they get a dog, need to stop and think about, yeah, they may be cool, they can skateboard and surf and do all these, mine don't, but, you know, they can do all these weird things and they look cool, let's get one. But you really have to stop and think about, what's this going to cost me, not only in food, but in the veterinary care that's required. A couple of the other breeds were a little surprising to me. Bernese Mountain Dog. Not surprising. I mean, it's not a very popular breed, but they are a breed that gets a lot of cancer, a lot of orthopedic diseases. Rottweilers, same thing. Ruptured anterior cruciate ligaments, and they become hypothyroid, and they can have elbow issues, lots of things with them. Great Danes. Yay, they're big. They have the same issues. A lot of orthopedic disease, as well as things like bloat, where their stomach can twist. And then the little French Bulldog, you know, the smaller version of the English Bulldog. So, you know, again, if
there
you get any of these dogs, do your homework, because I have people come in and say, well, I just can't afford the veterinary care. What's going on here? And I'm like, well, you chose the breed, not me. So,
get some insurance.
Get insurance if you're going to get one of these breeds.
One other topic before we go to the phones that interested me, it had to do with women who use topical estrogen. That was surprising.
That was kind of surprising. This is something that has come out from the FDA. They put out a warning regarding women that use a topically applied estrogen called Evamist, E-V-A-M-I-S-T. And they've been finding that just contact with their pets or with children, because you usually apply it on your arm.
Yeah.
You can get enough estrogen transfer that we are estrogenizing some children as well as pets, where they're developing mammary tissue.
Ooh.
They may develop symptoms like they're coming into heat. For kids, much, you know, very serious, and that they can become and have puberty faster and so on. So they're recommending that if you are using this product and you have pets, keep your pet away from it, and maybe consider wearing long sleeves when you're using this product.
And give the name of that product again.
I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. Evamist, E-V-A-M-I-S-T.
Okay. Yep. Well, we have lots more we can talk about, and I have all kinds of questions, but you know what? Every one of our lines is filled. So let's take a call. Scott in Green Bay, we go to you. Thank you for calling, Scott. Hi.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You know, I'm glad you're on to my little mini schnauzer's had a couple, rough 3 weeks or so. He went in for a dental, had to get a tooth pulled and a teeth cleaning, ended up getting 11 teeth pulled.
Oh!
I have no idea if this is any related at all. You know, a day or two after surgery was back to normal, but as soon as he was back to normal, he was licking his rear end. He was basically always twisted around, licking behind there. A couple days went by, didn't change, so I called the vet. They said, oh, bring him in. Sounds like anal glands. We went in, they expressed his anal glands. Yep, there was a bunch in there. He should be good in a day. Next day, he was licking probably more, so we took him in the following day, and they didn't get any out. They said they shaved a little bit around there, and this is what just seeing text at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The weekend went through, and about midweek the next week, he was still doing it. I mean, he never stopped licking back there, and it was weird. He would, you know, he was either looking at it or licking it.
Okay.
I felt back. He was, like, twisted around like a donut. Anyways, we finally went to see a vet there, and he couldn't find anything. He, again, tried to express the anal glands. Nothing came out. He was mystified. Gave him an injection of prednisone, put him on prednisone for probably about 4 days with absolutely no change, so brought him back. weaned him off the prednisone. Still licking back there, and my wife and I are just at wit's end. We feel so bad for the little guy.
Yeah. So what's going on, Sandy?
I don't know. I mean, a couple things. When he's had all these teeth pulled, it's possible that if he had a little soft stool, a diet change, because he had all this oral surgery done to a softer food, it may have affected the consistency of his fecal material, which may have allowed the anal glands to fill up. So that may have started it. And sometimes, even though they're empty, there may still be some inflammation back there. And what I would have done in this case is probably, rather than go with treating the entire body with steroids, actually infusing the anal glands with a steroid solution. You can do this, it depends on the dog, but most dogs, when they're awake, you just drop a little tiny plastic tube down into the duct of the anal gland and infuse some medicine in there and see if that makes a difference. The other thing I probably would have done is said, let's put an e-collar on your dog just so they don't traumatize the skin around the rectum if he's constantly licking.
Yeah.
It may just become a vicious cycle. But with all that said, I have seen schnauzers overrepresented for a compulsive disorder that involves exactly what you're describing.
Oh.
Your dog went through a pretty major stressful event, having oral surgery done and all this, you know, which is why you probably should need to be brushing those few remaining teeth. But, you know, I just wonder, this is one of the things that we'll see. It's kind of like, you know, someone biting their nails to the quick or twisting their hair or doing something compulsively. This happens to be something that I've seen a lot of schnauzers do. And my thought was that it may be the fact that their tail is docked and they may be getting some weird nerve sensations back there. But you look at all the dogs that get their tails docked, and this isn't a common problem for them. So I'm wondering if something didn't trigger your dog to, you know, have now this has become kind of a compulsive thing. And it may have been a combination of I was stressed, my anal glands were full, you know, and now I'm going to continue to look back there. A couple of things you can do. Make sure you're not rewarding the behavior inadvertently. If you are stopping what you're doing and saying, well, what are you doing, little guy? You know, you're licking at your butt. What's wrong with you? And you're worrying over him. It's a great way to get attention. So try to ignore the behavior if you can. I'd also try to, if they can't find anything medically wrong back there, try to put something on his backside that tastes bad. So if he gets a lick of it, it may deter him from wanting to go back and do that again. Kind of like putting that awful tasting stuff on your fingernails if you're a chronic fingernail biter. And your vet can make some suggestions. There's a gel that I like to use called Yuck that tastes horrible. Don't get it on your fingers. It tastes bad. You know, you can, you know, there's a number of things, bitter apple and different things like that you can try. But I that's where I would go. I'd try to break it from the behavior standpoint. And maybe, you know, down the road, you may be looking at needing to put your dog on Prozac or something. But I think that's really premature.
Good luck, Scott. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Wow. Dan in Partyville has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for this program.
Sure.
My wife has two dwarf rabbits. They tend to have a diarrhea problem. She feeds them pellets in the morning, and then the evening she feeds them a big bowl of salad, lettuce, broccoli, some carrot, a little bit of apple. We see a lot of cecropes that aren't being eaten also, and we want to know what to do with the diarrhea problem. Well, we've read that they should get greens 3 times a day.
Well, I don't know if it's like greens as you're feeding, but more probably hay and things like that.
They get Timothy hay constantly.
Okay.
That's never taken away. That's always there. They don't get no alfalfa.
Yeah. I'm worried about all the apples and other things that are in there as well. Those are pretty high sugar foods and a lot of moisture in those as well, and that may be what's causing the problem.
Yeah.
So a couple things that I would do, since these guys are housed together and they're both affected, make sure that you don't have a parasite that could be causing some trouble. And so, you know, having stool samples checked for intestinal parasites, and then give them the appropriate medication to get rid of those if necessary. And then actually writing down your diet and having your veterinarian that works with your rabbits have a look at it and make sure that it is appropriate. My guess is they're probably going to say, you know, stick with more of the pellets as well as the hay, and, you know, avoid all the vegetables, other vegetables and things that you may be using. A little bit of greens once in a while, but I think you're probably overdoing it on that end.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Dan. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question for our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, as we talk your pet's health. The number, 1-800-642-1234. or email us at talk@wpr.org. John in Milwaukee, you are up. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
This is John from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay, what can we do for you, John?
I have an Irish wolfhound, and he has health insurance.
Okay, good, good.
And about a year and a half ago, he's 9.5 years old.
That's a good age for an Irish wolfhound. Yep.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so we have him, he has a lot of pain. We have him on 9 pills of tramadol a day and 2 Remedil, 100 milligrams, twice a day.
Okay.
And our veterinarian said that she did not see him probably living through the winter because of the cold.
Okay.
And he has become not real incontinent, but, you know, we have a scatter rug in front of the door and he wets on there. And when he poops, he stands up and says, gee, what is that?
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if there's any connection with the pain relievers with this activity. Just old age.
Yeah.
What's going on?
It sounds like, I mean, is he incontinent with his fecal material where it just drops out of him?
He can get up and stand up and it falls out.
Okay. So it sounds like he's got some neurologic issues affecting the nerves that are going to his back end that you're seeing him now being unable to control his fecal material. Because dogs with just arthritic changes, yeah, they may be stiff and sore, but they'll hobble outside and may not be able to posture as normally as they would before, but should be able to get the job done, maybe with a little difficulty. But the fact that your dog's incontinent tells me that we probably have some nerve pain going on as well. And whether this is due to something like a slipped disc in the back, severe arthritis in the back, like spondylosis that's causing some spinal compression, spinal cord tumors, a whole host of things. And although, you know, I think that would be something your veterinarian should address with you as to whether you want to go down the pathway of getting some diagnostics done to see if there is something that could be repaired. We're usually looking for something that can be surgically repaired. But when it comes to medication that your dog is on, tramadol is an excellent pain reliever that can be combined with other drugs. It works upstairs, it works in the brain and makes the dog not recognize that it's uncomfortable. It can be a little sedating. Most dogs don't show anything more than that, and you shouldn't see fecal incontinence with it unless they are so out of it with the medication. But you said he's on 8 tablets of tramadol a day?
9 tablets, 3 tablets three times a day.
So you're using it 3 times a day. And actually, for a big dog like that, that's probably a fairly normal dose to think about using. So that sounds good. Remedil, 100 milligrams. I assume your dog is over 100 pounds?
He's 140 pounds.
Okay. I mean, you could actually go up higher on your Remedil as long as his liver and kidneys are working fine. The dose of that particular drug is about 1 milligram per pound of body weight twice a day. So you could go up maybe to 125 milligrams twice a day, but make sure, again, with your veterinarian that there's no underlying health issues that makes them want to use a lower dose. The other drug that I will sometimes add in to dogs that have especially neurologic discomfort and pain is a drug called Neurontin, and that's a human drug, and dogs tend to seem to tolerate it quite well. And there's another one called amantadine that we can use. So talk to your veterinarian about some of these other medications that can actually be used with the drugs that your dog's currently on. And then adding in things like joint supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate. Yeah, again, probably not going to do a whole lot, but may help, as well as a fatty acid supplement. Those are all things that may help relieve some of the inflammatory changes that are going on in his joints. And don't discount alternative care, chiropractic, acupuncture. I'm sitting here going with needles. Okay.
I was just about to blurt it out.
Yeah. Acupuncture and maybe working with a physical therapist so that he can maintain some of his residual muscle activity, even as he's aging. So, saying that, oh, we're going to give up this winter. I don't know. It all depends on, you know, how well you can cope with the incontinence, the fecal incontinence. It comes down to a management issue.
There you go. Good luck, John. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. Dr. Sandy, you mentioned to me that there was some new information out there about pet frogs and transmitting salmonella.
Salmonella, you know, and it's funny. I've had, for my daughter, since she's almost 18, going to be 18 in a couple weeks, ever since she was little, we ended up getting this thing called Grow a Frog or Love a Frog. It's this little kit that you can get at pet stores or at educational toy stores, and they send you a tadpole in the mail, and you watch it go through metamorphosis, and it's lifetime guaranteed. One dies, and you can get another one, and we're on our third one, so we've got a pretty good track record of having... You know, this is now our third frog, and she's almost 18. But, you know, these, I didn't even consider it, but these little pet frogs have been found to now, and these are what are called the pet African dwarf frogs or African clawed frogs.
Yeah.
Sell them in pet stores as adults as well. They carry salmonella, which is that bacteria that can make us quite ill. And what they have found is that there's been outbreaks where, you know, people have cleaned the aquarium in the kitchen sink and then used that for preparing food or, you know, handled the water in some way and then went and ate. So, and I am just as guilty. You know, I use my kitchen sink for cleaning the filter.
Sure.
And so they're telling you, you need to be careful and, you know, really, you know, be maybe not letting your kids be putting their hands in the aquarium. And, you know, just be aware that even these, you know, pretty benign looking little pet frogs may carry salmonella. In fact, I used to have a couple of other frogs that were unrelated to these, and their names were Sam and Ella. But yeah, that was, they were just regular, like little
plain old frogs.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Marianne in Lake Delton has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Marianne. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Sandy, for taking this call.
Oh, you're welcome.
My story is that I adopted, about 2 months ago, I adopted a dog from the local shelter. It was listed as a corgi mix, but actually the only thing that reminds me of a corgi is maybe the short, stubby legs and the turned-out feet.
Okay.
He has a long, slender body. He's short-haired. But when I brought him to my veterinarian for a checkup, he said, this dog has a rat terrier in him. And he said, I think he has beagle also. He is really, truly a mix.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very happy with my dog, but he has part behavior that really bothers me.
Okay.
He instead of coughing, he inhales in rapid, rhythmical, successive motions with his little rib cage is just going like bellows.
Uh-huh.
And it's very noisy, like he's snorting through his
mm-hmm.
nose. When I asked the vet about that, because I only noticed it a few times at that time, he said that it was a typical behavior of the beagle family
mm-hmm.
and that it would be maybe compared to a hiccup in reverse.
No, I'm going to disagree with that.
All right.
Okay. A hiccup is actually, and dogs hiccup, and we see it a lot in puppies and so on, they'll get the hiccups, and it's because your diaphragm, that muscular level, that layer that separates your chest cavity from your abdomen, is spasming, and that's what's causing changes and making those sounds. But what it sounds like your dog is doing, and if you've got computer access, I'd recommend that you go to YouTube and just look up reverse sneezing, and you will see tons of people. they videotape their dogs, and they put them on here. And I used to always mimic the sound that the dog would make. And now I don't have to. I just go in my office and turn the computer on and say, here, is this what your dog's doing? Yeah, that's what they're doing. And it's not a sneeze. It's but we call it a reverse
sneeze.
And mm-hmm. I agree with your veterinarian that it's very common in beagles. They typically have their nose to the ground and they're inhaling and sniffing. And what we think is happening is their soft palate, the back of the roof of their mouth, is getting caught up over their epiglottis, which is part of the their larynx, the anatomy in the back of their throat. And so this piece of tissue's back in there, and they are breathing really hard to suck air in, and it causes that vibration. Should I mimic the sound? Should I
give
do
it a try?
I'm pretty good at it.
All right, okay. Let's hear it.
All right, you ready? Okay. Is that similar to what your dog's doing?
That is exactly what
they do. Yay! I haven't lost it. Yay. Okay. And any dog can do this. And it combination of things that we think about. It could be dogs like my bulldogs that have the squashed face, the elongated soft palate. And so they do this all the time. It may be a dog that's busy sniffing and just kind of gets that soft palate caught up in there while they're busy inhaling. Sometimes we'll see it in dogs that have kind of chronic throat irritation, where their soft palate is bigger and meatier because they've been chewing on burrs out of their hair coat or something, and it caused some throat irritation. Sometimes we have no idea what causes it, but it's normal. It is not life-threatening. The best thing you could do for your dog is try to get them to swallow. So if he's treat-motivated, say, hey, you want a cookie? And offering them something gets them to swallow. It kind of flips everything back into place, and away you go. Oh, they're back to being normal again.
There you go. And, you know, my wife, Renee, has said that I sometimes sound like that in the night.
Well, you know, with snoring, it's all, everything is relaxing back there. And maybe that's why I'm so good at it, because I snore as well. Yeah, sometimes louder than my bulldogs.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Stephen, thank you, Marianne, for calling. Appreciate it. Stephen, Madison, let's turn to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a it's kind of a picky eater cat question.
Okay.
With a complication. And that is, I have a cat who was diagnosed as hyperthyroid, and so we put her on the methimazole for that, and of course that also ended up causing some kidney problems. So she's doing between the kidney and the methimazole and the hyperthyroidism, though she's doing pretty much okay. But the problem is that we have her on a low-protein diet, which she really doesn't like.
Yeah.
So I've had people tell me, you know, well, go ahead and give her a little regular cat food, but I'm leery of doing that.
Yeah, and you know, I think what you're experiencing is such a common problem for cats. They can be quite finicky with eating. And I just want to back up for a minute, because you had said you'd put your cat on methimazole, which is a drug that's commonly used for treating hyperthyroidism, and that the drug caused kidney disease. No, the kidney disease was already there. Many cats that are hyperthyroid, and that if they have kind of underlying kidney disease, the hyperthyroidism kind of masks the severity of the kidney disease. It increases the blood supply going to the kidneys because they're usually hypertensive and their heart rate's faster. And so they're pumping more blood at the kidneys. And as soon as you normalize that thyroid state and get the heart back into being normal and the blood pressure normal, guess what? You unmask what has happened to the kidneys. So whenever we're treating a cat for hyperthyroidism, we always want to do pre-treatment lab work. Then once we start treating, we get them back in again a few days later to check kidney values to see how we're doing, so we can make some adjustments with the dosages and things so that we can balance both diseases. And that's the problem. It's like a big teeter-totter. You want to treat the hyperthyroidism, but not treat it so much that you don't get the kidneys, you don't get the benefit of having her kidneys stay healthier longer. So a few things to think about when it comes to the low-protein diet. You're right. When cats have kidney disease, there are special kidney diets we like to have them on. And I don't know how many you have tried. When I have a cat that I want to put on a special diet, one, I always introduce it when they're feeling good. I want them to be happy and well hydrated and not nauseated and really feeling good. Because if they're feeling sick, you introduce a new food, guess what? The cat says, the food is what made me feel sick. They're very superstitious about that. So make sure she's feeling good. And then I send people home with at least probably 4 to 6 types of different brands of low protein diets. So there's KD, there's NF, there's multi-stage renal, there's, you know, you name the company, they've got the therapeutic diet for cats. So if your veterinarian doesn't have samples like that, they may be able to write you a prescription to another clinic to be able to pick something up, or to a local pet store that has a vet clinic associated with it that carries some of these therapeutic diets. But I'm also a big believer in quality of life. If your cat isn't eating, they're going to die, and they need food. And I have many, many kidney patients where we're like, oh, well, you have to survive. We're just going to feed you what you like to eat and do everything we else to, everything else we can do to keep you healthy and happy. So, like, you maintain your blood pressure and, you know, your potassium level and all those things. So good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. And Lynn in Asbury, Iowa, you are next. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Doctor, thank you for taking my call. I just got a question about pet insurance. I heard you talking about it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've got a really overall been healthy border collie mix that's either 7 or 8. I got it from a shelter about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And last year was really expensive. A couple, like, accidents, and then she had to have a mass tumor removed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's an expensive year for her. And I'm wondering, can you still buy insurance? Or do they have, like, pre-existing?
Yes, yeah, they do.
Just like regular insurance.
Yep, and so I can tell you, both of my dogs I adopted when they were 3. And purchasing insurance, I had to have their physical exam done. Well, that was easy because I could do it. And mail in the records. And that, you know, some of them want complete blood work. They want to have everything done ahead of time so they can assess whether this is going to be economically feasible for them to be able to take this dog on their policy. So it kind of depends on the policy and your dog's past history. And yes, there are sometimes, you know, diseases and things that have happened in the past. They may not include those. And some of the insurance companies even have different breed restrictions. Like if you have, you know, a standard poodle, they may not cover you for a dilated stomach because it's so common in the breed, or Addison's disease. So you need to check with the company. They're all different. I don't have a favorite one. I think it depends on the breed of your dog. There, you know, lots of them out there. So do your homework. The one that I'm using right now is called VPI, Pet Insurance, VPI.
Yeah.
I know Nestle Purina now has a pet insurance company. There's a number of them out there. So do your homework and find out if one would work well for your pet.
There you
but
go.
It probably would not include a lot of things because of pre-existing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah. And it's probably cheaper if you start when the cat or whatever is very right. Yeah.
I'd hate to even think what it would cost for my dogs now being senior bulldogs.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm paying under $300 a year for their insurance. So, and I've got it back on my female dog. She's had a couple of eye surgeries done and so on. My male, knock on wood, I've never had to have a claim form. Yay.
Yeah, so, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a very good thing. Jenny in Menominee, let's turn to you now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, I have a question about our cat who has started scratching the furniture. He's 4 years old. We've had him since he was a kitten, and he's an exclusively indoor cat. He's a very accomplished mouser. We have an old house, so we need him for that service, and he does a really nice job. And all of a sudden, at about 3.5 years of age, he decided to start scratching the furniture. And I did some reading about it. I started trimming his nails, and that seems to make it even worse. I don't know if he, we haven't yet investigated or explored the idea of a scratching post. It seems like everyone I know that's ever had one of those, they buy these big structures and then the cats don't want them. So
well,
I don't know what you recommend.
I'm gonna say that's okay. All right. Don't listen to your friends anymore. All right. Cats scratch for three different reasons. They are leaving their scent behind. They're leaving a visual mark of where the clawed surfaces is. And then they're also honing their claws. So there's marking going on as well as some grooming behaviors as well. And when you stop and look at it that way, the places that cats like to scratch are going to be prominent areas so that when somebody walks into the house, they can say, oh, you have a cat. So you don't see cats going down into the basement in the furnace room and scratching something down there unless they've been punished so much and they still have this desire to do something. But they usually like the sofa or a chair or something that's a very prominent piece of furniture in your living room. So
that's exactly what he's doing.
Okay. So knowing that and knowing that the surface is usually something shreddable, let's design the ultimate scratching post for a cat. Ultimate scratching post would be in a prominent location. It's going to be right there where your cat's currently scratching.
And stable.
And stable, yeah. It can't tip over. And you look at some of these scratching posts that are designed, you get your average cat that's real vigorous with their claws, it's going to tip. Or they can't, it's not tall enough where they can't get a good drag or stretch. Or it's covered with something like the regular, like plush carpet, which doesn't shred. We need something covered with either sisal rope or fabric that's going to shred and be at least 4 feet tall, sturdy base. And then what are we going to do with the fact that he's already got something that he really likes to scratch on? You need to either remove that piece of furniture temporarily or cover it up with something that will not allow your cat to be able to see or smell what's there. So with plastic, they make some tape that's called sticky paws. That's kind of a double stick carpet tape that is like kitty fly paper. When they put their feet up on it, it sticks and they don't like the feel of it. Bubble wrap, tin foil, whatever. And it is really helpful to move your furniture a little bit and put the scratching post right there.
Okay.
So I would do that before I would think about doing anything else. Declawed cats can still mouse, but I'm not a big fan of declawing unless you've tried everything. And it's a matter of we're going to get rid of the cat if we can't solve this problem. So
what is the deal with him starting this at this age? He never tampered with the furniture at all until about 3 and a half.
Yeah, and it may be that there was a stray cat outside or something where he felt that he needed to put up a little street sign that, hey, this is where I live. So that may be all it was, is something triggered it. And then he was like, wow, this feels good. It smells like me now. I'm going to continue to use it. So things like
there
that happen. So who knows what the trigger was, but now you got to deal with it. So
there you go, Jenny. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Irene in Monona, it's your turn. Hello.
Hello there. Hi. Thank you. I've got two questions. First of all, what are the most, other than the obvious, I have a miniature dachshund, and I've had dachshunds all my life, and other than the back issues, what are the most common ailments that dachshunds might?
What they get. Yeah, well, you're right with the back issue. Those long, long dogs are very prone to running into troubles with slip discs, so keep them slender. Because of their very, pardon me?
10 pounds.
He's 10 pounds. So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty average weight for like normal weight for a dog. But, you know, if he just gained even a couple of pounds, that would be pretty significant. So make sure you keep them nice and slender. We see a lot of dental disease in dachshunds as well. And I think it's because they've got lots of teeth in that tight little mouth. And so I see many senior dachshunds that are gumming it because they've had to have teeth extracted. So do a good job of keeping your dog's teeth brushed and treated that way. We do see sometimes more skin issues with these guys. It's very common to see kind of hair loss and kind of natural balding in these dogs where they have very little hair on their head or their ears. Sometimes other places on their body, we sometimes will see, you know, primary seborrhea, different like skin, you know, other skin issues that happen more in the dachshund. We tend to see them happen in other dogs too. But those are the things that come to mind right away. Mm-hmm. Are
no internal organs.
Internal?
No more than any other small breed dog. I mean, they do get heart disease, and we will see, you know, heart failure in these guys as they get older. You know, they can run into kidney disease and so on, but it's probably not at any higher rate than you would see in other small breed dogs.
We do put linatone in her food for the skin.
Okay.
Now, before this dog, I have a mystery for you. We had a 9-year-old dachshund. Everything was normal. And she was doing reverse sneezing, which I'm finding is pretty normal for them. But it got to where she wouldn't stop.
Yeah.
And I took her to the vet. They did all kinds of tests and all kinds of anything, blood. They sent her home with me. She didn't stop and didn't stop, and she died in bed with me that night.
Oh, my goodness.
Think of anything. I mean, it was a big mystery. We still don't know why that dog died.
Well, I'm not sure if the reverse sneezing was the cause of it or not, but when we see dogs that suddenly, I mean, doing it once and it lasts for a few seconds and it goes away, big deal. But it's when it's constant like this, then we start worrying about, is something wrong with the back of their throat? And I've had several patients in my career where I've had to send them in for kind of emergency surgery where they get a soft palate resection. We actually take off a piece of the real meaty soft palate that they're constantly inhaling. And so whether she had something wrong in the back of her throat that was causing some respiratory obstruction. I don't know how detailed your veterinarian, you know, was with their exam, but these are tough ones to examine. You do need to have them under anesthesia to be able to get a good look back there, because you just can't visualize it in the an awake dog. So it does take anesthesia to have a look.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. It's been a mystery for 10 years now.
So. Oh, I'm sorry that you lost your dog.
I am too. Thank you very much.
You know, one of the things that I always like to bring up when we have a case like this, where someone for 10 years has been like, I don't know what caused my dog's death, is consider having an autopsy done. Many people don't even consider it, and they bury their dog, they have them cremated, and then they're always wondering, is it something I did? Is it something I neglected? Could I have fixed this? And often we're just making guesses. So, you know, this is something that all veterinarians are trained in as to how to do. It's something that all the students that we have they go through a rotation and they learn how to do a very thorough autopsy. We actually call it a necropsy on pets. But I think that's the thing that I find, it gives closure, and you know what happened to your pet.
Yep, absolutely. Irene, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She is a clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online, so we will go right back to the phones. And let's turn to Pam in Ladysmith next. Pam, hello.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I have a cat that sheds a lot, and she just got done having her physical, her yearly physical. They did, last year they told me to try the oil to put in her food. I had salmon oil. I've tried the vitamin E oil. She won't eat her food. So is there anything else I can do to help with that shedding?
Well, when we look at shedding, there's what we call essential shedding and non-essential shedding. Essential shedding is the cat's individual hair coat turnover. And some cats shed more than others. And I know people will say, I don't want to get a long-haired cat because they shed too much. I actually find that the shorter-haired cats, their hair is a little more problematic. It's because it's kind of spiky and it gets stuck in everything. Long-haired cats tends to clump more and you can clean it up a little bit easier. So that's something that's just genetics. And it's, you know, if you've got an indoor cat that is exposed to artificial light, they're going to be shedding year round, regardless of what you do. The other part of shedding is what I call the non-essential shedding, which you can sometimes affect with diet. So if you've got a cat on a really poor diet, you know, like a generic yucky cat food, no matter how much you throw at it with supplements, it's probably not going to make any difference. So go with the best diet that you can get for your cat. And this would be, you know, one of the national brands. Be careful that you don't let your cat get overweight, because when they're overweight, they can't groom themselves. And so you're going to find that they can't swallow the hair and you're going to have more hair around your house. So, you know, as long as your cat's on a good diet, then it comes down to you just need to hike up your grooming. And I had an owner in the other day that had bought one of these brushes called a Furminator. Mm-hmm. And she overdid the fermination a little bit.
Oh,
this
no.
cat came in. I'm like, why are there bald spots all over your cat? And she goes, well, I got a little aggressive with it. So you can actually pull out more hair. But I found that for many, like especially short-haired cats, that works really well. And don't hesitate to bathe your cat if the cat will tolerate it. That may help loosen up hair and you'll have, you know, more to deal with shortly after they're dry. You can get all that dead hair out of there. And that may cut down a little bit of the shedding for the next few days. But a lot of cats don't see the humor in bathing. But
no, they don't.
Watch out for those supplements, though. Some cats are very fussy. And when you start changing the texture of the food with adding oil to it, and it's not just any oil. You're really looking at balanced fatty acids when you're wanting it to affect the skin. So, that's all I can tell you. Brush, brush, brush.
Brush, brush, brush. And your cats are really, you're right, cats can be really finicky. Now, we give our two cats, very good quality food, and we change it up a little bit. And I've found that they do not like chicken.
Yep, that's just your particular cats. And I have two cats right now at home that They would not touch human food for the life of them. You could put out roast turkey and they would just look at it like, what is this? And yet one of my cats, I put out cantaloupe. Oh, my God. I cannot have a cantaloupe in the house. I mean, she will gnaw through the skin, the you know, the husk on the outside to be able to get into the cantaloupe. So, you know, every cat's an individual and it just it's, you know, some of it's how they were raised when they were little and it's just individual tastes. So.
Jim and Menasha, we turn to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi, doctor. I about a month ago, I paid for slash rescued a cockatoo that was for sale. And this bird, the entire chest of it has been plucked bare of feathers, and the rest of her backside is all ratty looking. And in the last couple of weeks, some of these kind of nastier looking feathers in that area have turned more fluffy, but she's not growing back any feathers on her chest. And I'm wondering, I think I'm feeding her right. I'm trying various fruits and stuff like that, as well as nuts. But
so this feather picking started after you adopted her, or
no,
it was going on before you adopted her?
She was like that when I got her.
Okay.
The reason I was willing to put up the money on it is to help the birds. So.
Yeah, and how nice of you to do that, because, I mean, these birds live a long time. I think when you look at feather picking, you can break it down into kind of, and I'm not an avian specialist by any means, but you can break it down into kind of two categories. One is the behavioral kind of compulsive disorder, the bird that's worried and stressed, again, looking like a person biting their fingernails. Then you look at it from the health standpoint. Do they have external parasites that are bothering them where they're itchy and they're plucking at themselves? Or do they have, you know, some type of hormonal imbalance or, you know, that type of thing? So whenever you get a feather plucking bird, it's real important that you work with a veterinarian that is comfortable working with birds and knows birds. This would not be a patient that you would want to bring to see me, okay? Even though I have two birds at home, I use another veterinarian for their medical care because they, you know, they're so different than the mammalian species that I'm dealing with. So with my, you know, dogs and cats as my regular patients. So I would look into that and not just be looking at what you can do dietarily, but, you know, get a good health evaluation done on the bird. And then they can also assess, you know, how the bird is housed and what you're feeding and so on. That's all part of the evaluation, is looking at husbandry as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Eric in Baraboo emailed us, Dr. Sandy, and wonders, what's the best way to get rid of cat urine spray smell? Now, he's tried various pet store products, also white distilled vinegar and other things, but nothing seems to do the trick.
And there's nothing different between cat spray smell and urine, okay? Mm-hmm. All that is urine that's small amounts that are deposited usually on vertical objects. And so the cat's backing up, quivering its tail, and shooting out a stream of urine. And it's a matter of finding something that's going to work for cat urine. My two favorite products that you can go online and look them up, and here in Madison, there's many places that sell them locally. They do an online service as well, and you can order them. One is called Urine Off. Comes with you can order it with a black light as well that will highlight where the urine is at night, so you know exactly where to treat. It's important to make sure that you use enough of the product to get down into the flooring and so on. So if it's hit the wall and run down the baseboard, you got to treat behind the baseboard. You got to treat the carpet, the subflooring and so on. So it really takes some multiple doses of this to be able to get the urine smell under out of the area. But I found that one is probably the most effective. The other one that I really like is called AIP, Anti-Icky Poo. That one actually comes with a syringe and needle, so you can inject it down into through the carpet pad down to the floor, which is where all the odor is residing, down in that subflooring. So good luck.
Eric also has a four-month-old Shih Tzu puppy, wondering what health issues this breed is at risk of developing.
Oh, well, because they have those big bulgy eyes, that we see a lot of eye injuries, corneal ulcers, sometimes a result of, you know, roughhousing with another dog or having their hair rubbing on their face, which is why you'll see a lot of little Shih Tzus with their hair up in a barrette and, mm-hmm. you know, ponytail, or that their face is trimmed clean. So that's probably one of the big things we see is eye injuries. Because they have that short face, some of them are born with what we call brachycephalic syndrome, which is the tiny nostrils, elongated soft palate, tinier windpipe, so they can have a hard time breathing, and some of that can be surgically corrected. Dental disease, because you've got all those teeth crowded in the mouth, they're more prone to having dental issues as well. Other than that, you know, they maybe have a little bit of like kneecap luxation and, you know, where their kneecaps are a little sloppy. But those are probably the big things that we see.
Let's turn to Lou in Rosendale next. Lou, hello.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
I have two cats. One is a domestic short hair 3-year-old, and the other one is an 18-year-old Siamese. And they both have a dry hacking spasmodic cough periodically, and the 18-year-old has done this pretty much all of her life, and it doesn't happen every day or maybe once a week or less.
Are they indoor cats?
Totally indoor cats. Okay. They'll lay flat on their stomachs and just, you know, it's sort of like they're having a spasm, but they'll just continuously do this dry hacking cough like they're...
And what's been done for diagnosis? Have you had them in for anything? Okay.
I haven't had them in at all because I have a couple issues. I had the Siamese got the terrible respiratory disease when she was in for spaying.
Uh-huh.
And because they're indoor only and I only have the two of them, never have any contact with any other animals,
okay.
I don't get them immunized either. But
well, I'm going to just back you up here before we get to the coughing. This is a kind of one of those myths that people have is that, you know what, I have totally indoor cats, never have to worry about getting them vaccinated. Well, you know what? If they were to bite somebody, you're liable, and you will have to show proof of rabies. And so it's maybe not a state law, but it is a local ordinance in almost every community across Wisconsin. So make sure that you maybe talk to your insurance agent and just say, hey, you know, I've got these unvaccinated cats. What would happen? Because, you know, you do have to show proof of rabies, current rabies vaccination. And some of the viruses... like panleukopenia, also known as cat distemper, can survive for an extended period of time in the environment to the point where if you just go to a pumpkin patch or, you know, a farmer's market where there's maybe stray cats around and you get some of this virus on your clothing, you can bring it home and transmit it to your cats. So you've been lucky. I really think that what we need to do, number one, is get them in for a good physical exam. Things that would cause cats to cough. We don't see cats coughing very often, but it's usually not hairballs, which is what many people think. Oh, they're trying to cough up a hairball. Hair isn't in the airways. Hair is in the stomach, and they vomit up hairballs. When we see a cat coughing, I worry about things like asthma. I don't know if there's any smokers in the family, but if there's a lot of particulate matter in the air, the hair house is dusty, that can be one of the things that can aggravate this. We can see cats coughing with heartworm disease. Unlikely, because your cats are indoors and probably not exposed to mosquitoes, and they're from Wisconsin. There's other parasites and things that can live in the lungs, and again, with their lifestyle, unlikely. But I think it would be a good idea to get them in and have them looked at. And if you're concerned about having them, you know, be at the hospital, then perhaps go in, get a physical exam, get them vaccinated, and then let them go back in for any workup that they may need so that they are well protected before they're hospitalized again.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Lou. Don in Superior, it's on to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi. Doctor, I have a English setter. She's 9 years old, and what she likes to do is nest. She's always been a nester, and she nests even harder on the carpeting when we leave her alone.
Mm-hmm.
And because she's doing that so much, she's starting to tear up the carpeting. She's getting worse. And she's also got a 5-year-old daughter who seems to be following suit.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. And when you say nesting, I assume you mean digging a spot?
Yeah, well, she'll just scratch the carpeting all, you know.
Okay.
And she'll go to three or four different places sometimes.
Okay. And that's pretty normal behavior for dogs to, you know, move their bedding around and so on to make it comfortable, and then they lay down. The fact that she's doing this and it's getting worse when she's left alone makes me think that you may be dealing with a condition called separation anxiety, which is the fear of being left alone. And they'll sometimes do these repetitive motions. They'll, you know, they'll pace. They may howl. They may self-mutilate themselves. There's a whole bunch of things that they could do. But I'd be looking at it from that point of view is, you know, is she stressed with being left alone? And this is her way of dealing with the stress by digging in the carpet. And also if she's not, you know, if she hasn't been spayed, we will see dogs doing more nesting when they're having a false pregnancy. So, you know, make sure that she's not hormonally challenged and doing that. But it sounds like she's doing it all the time, and it's probably not just heat-related type behavior.
So she needs a little behavior modification.
Probably. That needs to be assessed. And that would be taking a good behavior history. These appointments for me usually take an hour to an hour and a half.
Okay, so that can be done with a veterinarian.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yep.
All right, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Dr. Sandy, you had some information about children and dog bites.
Yeah, and it's something that, as a mother and as a dog owner, it's something that I think we all need to be aware of. And this is a study done at University of Colorado in Denver, and they looked at over 500 dog bite injuries that had been presented to the hospital from kids up to 18 years of age. And what they found was that the great majority of them, 68% of them, were kids under five. So what that tells me is that, you know, you really need to supervise young children around dogs. And so you need to have a parent with the child when they're interacting with the dog. But the other thing that was really interesting was that almost half of the pets were family pets. And that meant that, you know, they were known pets. You knew the dog. Some of them belonged to neighbors, and about 13% belonged to friends, and 10% belonged to other relatives. So almost all of them were dogs that the child and the family has probably had interaction with. So, and guess which was the number one dog to bite children?
Oh, I bet you it's a little one.
Nope, Labrador Retrievers
is
what was reported. Part of this was out of, because this was from Colorado and Denver, where pit bulls are banned, they didn't even show up on the list. But, Labrador Retrievers, Rottweilers, and German Shepherds. Those are the big ones. So what this comes down to is if you've got kids and you've got a dog, even if it's a well-loved family dog that has never had a history of biting, things can happen.
Yeah.
Always supervise your children, especially kids under five.
Kim and DeForest, we turn to you now. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I was calling because my dog had recently had lungworm, and he was on a medication for 14 days called Panacure liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took him back in, and in the stool it showed that the lungworm was gone. But every once in a while when he breathes, I hear like wheezing, almost like it sounds bronchial.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what that could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that he's just had enough damage from the parasite living in his lungs that he has some residual lung changes. It could be something totally unrelated, that he's got some bronchitis or something going on. I don't know if you've been in for, or had your dog in for a chest x-ray, but that would be the first step, is get a chest x-ray and see if there are any visible abnormalities in the lung fields.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and I think then they can make a decision as to do you go to the next step? Do you do a what's called a BAL, bronchial alveolar lavage, to look for indications of infection? What I worry about is sometimes these parasitic infections will set up an inflammatory change in the lungs that involve a white blood cell called an eosinophil. And some of these dogs need to be on, you know, steroids and things like that for a little bit to be able to get that inflammation down from their lungs. But this would be something that x-rays are going to show, and perhaps getting some of the material from the lungs up. And that is an anesthetic procedure. It's quick. They're down and up really fast. But it may help direct your veterinarian as to what would be the appropriate treatment.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in La Crosse, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hello, everybody. Sandy, I had actually talked to you a few years ago about my daughter's dog in Georgia. She lives in South Georgia, and they had a Great Dane that she actually bought out of a back of a pickup in a Walmart parking lot and just fell in love with the pup. My children and my grandchildren are all absolute dog lovers. They kept that dog alive 2 or 3 years beyond what he should be simply because of the love, and their best friend is a veterinarian and good medication. Now they want another dog, but their needs are, they live in the middle of about a 40-acre cleared pine forest, and it's very isolated, and I have a 17-year-old granddaughter, 12-year-old grandkid, mm-hmm. and they miss the protection when the dog would go out, and so they want another large dog. Mm-hmm. They want one that's going to be as healthy as possible, because they've certainly spent a lot on medications over the many years, and another Great Dane is a possibility as long as they get the breeding right.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also saw a standard poodle, and I've heard a lot of wonderful things about a standard poodle.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I saw at Pet Smart last week said, "Oh yeah, they are protective because we want them to be protective." I thought of, I think, is there a giant or a large wire-haired terrier? And what would you recommend? And
okay. Oh, good questions. You know, I typically, when I get this question, I'm in the grocery store or someplace at a party, and my pat answer is, I don't pick your spouse. I'm not picking your dog, okay? Because it's all what you can care for and you want to live with. Obviously, I started the show out earlier talking about, you know, the expense of different breeds of dogs, and Great Danes are right up there in the top five for medical expenses. So some of it's going to depend on your ability to, you know, cover medical expenses. So what do I tell people to do when they're looking for a dog? Number one is take your time. Don't just jump in and say, and pick the first dog that you find. Work with, if you do find a breeder, my idea of the only guarantee you should have from a breeder is lifetime. That means that breeder is breeding the best dogs that they know how to do. They're screening for health problems. They're making sure that those puppies are going to be placed in the appropriate home. So often they may turn you down. They may say, nope, with the age of the children, where you live or whatever, the care you can provide, you're not an appropriate home for this puppy. And don't be surprised, because the reason why they give a lifetime guarantee is they don't want this dog to become a burden to society, and they want that dog to come back to them if it needs to be rehomed. And the last thing they want is to have to rehome a dog that has not been through training class, that has not been socialized appropriately, and maybe non-adoptable. So those are kind of basic guidelines that I like to look at. And, you know, when you're saying you want a dog for protection, I look at my two dogs that are probably sound asleep on the couch right now. And if somebody were to go up and ring the front doorbell, they would just wander over and stand at the top of the stairs and look out the door. And nobody in their right mind would come in, because they see this head the size of a bowling ball. And yet these dogs are very friendly and wouldn't hurt anybody. But it's just sometimes the presence of the dog. So, you know, don't be looking for a dog that is territorial or aggressive or anything, because you're just going to be setting yourself up for liability issues, and you're working with a loaded gun there. It was a really interesting thing that was published, where they talked about the difference between family dogs and resident dogs. And family dogs are dogs that actually live in the house with the family, and resident dogs are dogs that are usually housed outside and, not part of the family. And those resident dogs have a much higher rate of biting and causing trouble. So, they want a family dog, so it needs to be something that can live in their home with them. And so looking at shedding, the size of the dog, the amount of care that they can have, and I'm not going to make a recommendation of a breed. So there we go. Long-winded, but
it's a good answer,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, do your homework first. Visit a lot of dog shows, talk to people, and read between the lines when you're looking at breed specifications and so on as to what their personalities are like. I love it when I see things like, a one-person dog. Well, yeah. You got a dog that's probably going to be pretty antisocial then, if that's what the breed's like. So
yeah. You don't want that. Good luck. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Janice in Antioch, Illinois, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Janice.
Hi. You wouldn't believe it, but right now I'm sitting at a dog park, and there's got to be at least 25 dogs running around out here.
Good.
Fantastic. And I'm calling about my cat.
Okay.
I have taken him to the vet. His last checkup was about 6 months ago, and I told the vet that I was pretty sure I found blood in when he did his VM.
Okay.
And I wiped his butt, and I said, this is from his butt. And the vet said, he more or less poo-pooed me.
Mm-hmm.
And
so to speak.
And said that he thought it was probably from urine. And I said, no.
Yeah.
And I know he sat down a few times after he's gone to the bathroom, and I would find some on a white rug, or he had an accident one time when he got locked in a bedroom, and he went on a pile of papers,
mm-hmm.
and there's a little bit of blood. And
now, is his stool normal, or does he have diarrhea?
No, it's very hard.
Okay, that may be part of it. When we see Frank blood on the stool, or you know, maybe a drip after defecating, things that I think about are, you know, is it just that the stool's too bulky or too hard and causing some colonic irritation? Do we have a problem with one of the anal glands being infected and maybe bleeding? Because those get expressed when they're having a BM as well. So I'd be looking at checking your cat's anal glands. Cats don't see the humor in having rectals done, and thank goodness for them. The way their anal glands are anatomically placed, you can express them from the outside of their body fairly easily to assess what the contents are like there. I also worry about things like polyps and tumors and things. And the reason why I asked about the consistency of your cat's fecal material is that if he was having diarrhea, we worry about things like inflammatory bowel disease and colitis, and that needs to be treated a whole different way. So you may want to be looking at, is there some way you can increase the moisture in your cat's stool by maybe feeding something with a little more fiber in it, like adding a little pumpkin to their diet. Some cats like that. Just canned pumpkin, not the pumpkin pie filling that has all the spices in it, but just, you know, canned pumpkin. Or perhaps changing the diet to something that may change the consistency of the stool so they're just not as dry.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Sherry. Has a 1.5-year-old female border terrier, weighs about 19 pounds, doesn't like dry dog chow, only eats it reluctantly if she adds a dollop of canned food to it, and she's tried 5 different brands of dry chow. 3 weeks ago, the dog barely survived ingesting 20 ibuprofen tablets.
Ooh.
And while in the vet clinic for 4 days, she was frequently fed small amounts of wet food. Since then, she really has turned up her nose at the dry chow.
Yeah, well, that dog is lucky to be alive. 20 yeah. ibuprofen tablets, you know, they can cause dogs to run into liver and kidney issues. And so I hope that she's going back for some follow-up lab work to make sure that the dog doesn't have some underlying health reason why it's not wanting to eat. But, you know, 19 pounds for a border terrier, that's, they're a small terrier, and so that might be, I'm not that concerned about the dog's weight. It sounds like it's pretty normal weight for the dog, or maybe even a little bit heavy.
She gets a couple of dog bones a day, milk bones.
So it's, if it's eating milk bones, you know, I think sometimes we get that dog wraps us around their little paw and just wants, you know, it knows how to manipulate us. I actually, the worst case I ever had was an owner that had to sit on the floor, cross-legged in front of the dog dish, hand feed her dog and sing show tunes.
Ah.
Dog definitely wanted a dinner show, and that was the only way the dog would eat. So, you know, I think not making a big fuss about meals. I always ask, how long have you left the food down? How many days does the dog go without eating before you break down and add something? And I think we're always wanting to add something if the dog doesn't just, you know, chow down right away. So be careful. Put the food down. The dog may look at you and say, well, where's the good stuff? When they get hungry, they'll eat. Now, I don't recommend going for days, but I also would recommend, you know, if it goes 24 hours, big deal, you know. Look at kibble size, you know, the texture, maybe what you're feeding the kibble in. It could be the dish or whatever. But, you know, just don't get sucked into over, you know, feeding your dog something special, because that's what happens.
Chris in Sparta, hello to you.
Hi, Larry and Sandy. Thanks for being able to take time to get me on.
Sure.
Got a quick question regarding dogs. I've got two Great Pyrenees, okay? One was probably purchased maybe 4 months ago, male dog, great dog, been very good in the home and welcomed my other 16-year-old dog. And now I felt compelled to adopt his brother, who also, I believe, is approximately a year and a half old. I think they're very
close.
Mm-hmm. Compatible. Yeah, they're brothers. And now I have had the brother for 3 days, and the brother is marking things all over the home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do we need to stop this? Is this just something that he's doing?
Is he is he neutered?
No.
Okay.
The first one is. The second one we just got is not.
All right. That would be the first thing to do, is kind of take the starch out of his sails a little bit by having him neutered. You've introduced two breed-matched, almost sex-matched, one's neutered, one isn't, age-matched dogs into a household. And that is that would not have been a recommendation that I would have made, because you can run into a lot of social interaction problems with competition between the two dogs. Even if they're brothers, they don't recognize that genetic link. And you can see more territorial marking, like what you're seeing, sometimes fighting, being possessive of you or sleeping areas or food or different things. And some of the worst fighting we see is between siblings. So first thing I would do is, when you hang up from talking with me, call your veterinarian and say, emergency, got to get this dog neutered. And that may help. But about 50% of dogs will continue to urine mark, especially if they're feeling socially stressed, and feeling like he's got to, put up all these, no trespassing signs and make everything smell like him. So that, that can still be a problem. So what do you do about that? You can try using the DAP diffusers, the dog appeasement pheromone, that comes in either a collar, a diffuser, a spray. That helps some of these dogs. Maybe be looking at, housing them a little bit differently, where they don't have to be constantly together, and that you are there supervising their interactions, so that there's, less of a chance for him to mark, and he starts learning that it's okay to mark outside but not indoors. But yeah, neuter him first, and then call me back next month.
All right. There you go, Chris. Thanks very much for calling. By the way, Sandy is back on December 14th. So as a reminder. So mark that on your calendar, Chris. Let's go to Amanda in Madison. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I've got a question about my seven to eight-month-old puppy. He is a Brussels Griffin and Poodle mix.
Oh, cute.
So
yeah,
he's kind of a circus dog. But he has ears that hang down, and he's been itching them pretty regularly. And when I look inside, I can see that he has a little bit of irritation and some brown gunk in there. And I'm wondering, is there something over the counter, or is this going to need to be a vet visit?
I would make it a vet visit, because the things that we would be doing, if you came in and reported that, first thing I would do is probably collect a swab out of both ears. And I would look at it not only for parasites such as ear mites, which sometimes can be a little tricky to find in dogs, but I'd be looking for those. And then I'd also be looking for signs of infection. So I would do cytology. I would smear it out and stain it and have a look to see, do we have bacteria there? Do we have yeast there? So that I can pick the appropriate product. It's uncommon for young dogs to start running into troubles, especially at this age, with allergies, which can cause the ears to itch. I worry more about parasitic infections or bacterial or yeast infections, which can happen when they're young like this. So I think going into your clinic and having those ears looked at would be the first thing, and then they can pick the appropriate medication.
Okay. Rhonda had emailed us with exactly the same question.
Okay.
Yeast and bacteria infection in her beagles.
There we go. And, those droopy-eared dogs, and especially, this one that has a poodle ancestry that we were just talking about with Amanda, can get a lot of hair in their ears, and that can really complicate getting an infection under control, because it just acts like a big plug or a wick and doesn't let air through there. So it may even come down to showing you how to groom your dog's ears appropriately to be able to keep that hair out.
There you go. Thanks, Amanda. Joellen and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Joellen.
Hi. Hi, Sandy.
Hello.
Hi. I have a couple questions. I have a small white dog. She was rescued. She's about 8 years old, and I think she's a Bolognese.
Okay.
She's kind of like a poodle-ish Bichon, little okay. white dog, and she has a cough. And I did take her to the vet, and they gave me some cough medicine for her, and all she did was throw that up, so we stopped doing that. But she still has a cough, and she does it quite frequently. And sometimes I'll say, are you okay? And then she'll stop. And maybe once in a great while she'll cough a little something out of her stomach, but usually nothing comes up.
Okay. You know, it's very when we have a dog that comes in and maybe has a history of going to a boarding kennel or going to a groomer, and they come in and they've got a sensitive trachea and they're not running a fever and they're active and they're feeling good, but they got a little cough, we start thinking that it could be kennel cough. And the issue with kennel cough is that it's not just one bug that causes it. We now know that canine influenza can cause coughing, and other viruses and bacteria and mycoplasma and all these things can cause coughing, as well as heart disease and other lower airway diseases and you know, allergic disease, lots and lots of different things. So even though they put your dog on a cough suppressant and it didn't help, and one, it may not have been the right drug for your dog, I think it's time to go back and say, let's take it to the next level. Chest x-rays would be the first step, a good listen to the lungs, so a good physical exam, chest x-rays, and then take things from there to see what's going on. Time to get to the bottom of this. We shouldn't just have your dog coughing all the time.
All right. Thank you for calling. Muriel emailed us and concerned about a cat. She's now keeping it indoors because the cat ate a field mouse. And her husband puts out mouse poison.
Oh, okay.
Anticoagulant. Wondering if there's a threat if your cat eats.
Yeah. I mean, they have to probably eat the stomach contents of the mouse, and it all depends on what they ate. And so it's possible. A relatively low risk, but still possible. And with some of these super potent rodenticides on the market, a very small amount could potentially cause toxicity for your cat. So I'm glad you're keeping your cat inside. That's probably safer for your cat. If you're concerned, take the bait or whatever you're using, take the package in so your veterinarian knows which one your cat may have had contact with so that they know the appropriate thing to be looking for. Do they need to be looking at, does your cat have a coagulation problem, or do we have a problem with calcium and vitamin D and so on, which would be looked at a different way? So take that package in with you, and that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about.
Very cool. And I wanted to get to this study on how cats drink here in the last minute or so.
Really interesting. You know, we think that we look at dogs' lap water, and we know that they kind of make a little ladle with their tongue and splash water all over the place, and they're just kind of scooping the water into their mouth. Turns out cats, about 4 times a second, use their tongue, and they actually curve it under a little tip, and they just touch the surface of the liquid, and then as they pull their tongue back, I mean, this is 4 times a second, they get this stream of water coming up, and before gravity takes over and lets that stream of water or milk or whatever it is drop back into the dish, they close their mouth and they have the water in their mouth, and they're doing this very, very frequently. So it's not surprising to see that cats, you know, I hear all the time, my cat likes to tap the water dish so that they can see where the surface is, because they have to just have their tongue hit that surface of the water, just the surface. It's not going down into it. So they have to know where that surface is. That's why maybe cats like running water too, because they can see the water a little bit better if there's a little bit of texture on the surface of the water.
So that's how cats
interesting
drink. Probably
thing.
Online we can probably see it.
It is. And you can actually see a slowed down video of a cat drinking. It's very, very interesting.
Well, this has been an interesting 90 minutes, as a matter of fact, Sandy. Thank you so much. You'll be back December 14th.
December 14th, and I'm looking forward to it.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest, and she will be back. Tomorrow, we'll talk about white nose syndrome in our bat colonies with Dave Riddell of the DNR. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.